So today we're going to pick up where we left off in our quest to compute cross sections and decay rates. So we'll go through today our Dyson's formula and Wick's theorem. And so over the last few lectures, we've made some progress in computing cross-sections and decay rates. First, we were able to relate those cross-sections and decay rates to scattering amplitudes. And then last time, on Friday, we saw how to relate scattering amplitudes to Green's functions in interacting theories. So these time-ordered vacuum expectation values, products of fields. So this is what we want to compute. We've got n fields here. And today, we're going to learn how to compute these quantities by relating these endpoint functions involving products of n interacting fields to products of n free fields. So that will be the first step. That's what I'm calling Dyson's formula. And then these time-ordered products of free fields are not very difficult to compute. We've already, in the beginning of this course, we computed the a product like this for two fields. And so Wick's theorem will give us a general method for computing these products with n fields, and it will relate the product time-ordered product of n fields to the two-point function, which we, or Feynman propagator, which we've already computed. That's where we're going, and then at the end of lecture, we'll have enough information to, in principle, compute cross-sections and decay rates. And then tomorrow, we'll look at a more efficient but entirely equivalent way to do what we've spent three lectures doing. The more efficient way is the method of Feynman diagrams. So the main method we're going to use in order to do this first step, to relate this Green's function of interacting fields to this Green's function for free fields, is going to be by going to the interaction picture, which is kind of a hybrid between the Heisenberg and the Schrodinger picture. To go to the interaction picture, we need to first break up our Hamiltonian into two parts, some free part, which you can imagine is the Klein-Gordon Hamiltonian, although we won't need the explicit form of the Hamiltonian anywhere in what we're about to do. So we'll work for other choices of free Hamiltonian. And with very little modification, what we're doing here will work also for fermions and gauge bosons. So some free part and some perturbation, which I'll call H1. And you can imagine this as like a cubic interaction or quartic interaction term. So this could be something like the integral of lambda over 4 factorial pi to the 4th. But the precise form, again, won't matter. Okay, and so the interaction picture, the nice feature of the interaction picture is that our fields are just going to evolve with our free Hamiltonian. And so in essentially every way that matters, they'll behave precisely what like free fields, and so I'm going to call them free fields. So the in the interaction picture, the fields evolve like this. Where this here is the Schrodinger picture field operator. And with the subscript 0 means the interaction picture field operator. You can think of these as free fields because they behave just like free fields. So this is the, if I got rid of the T naughts, this would be the same equation that is familiar to you from earlier in the course that relates the Schrodinger picture fields to the free Klein-Gordon field. I'm adding the T naught because we can, the Schrodinger picture and Heisenberg picture should agree at some time. Up to now, we've chosen that time to be T equals 0. There's no reason that that has to be T equals 0, so I'm just allowing for the more general possibility here that the Heisenberg and Schrodinger pictures agree at some time T naught. And we'll also demand that the interaction picture fields also agree with the Heisenberg and Schrodinger picture fields at that same time. And so what we need to do in order to relate this Green's function that we're interested in involves interacting fields to the simpler product that just involves free fields, is we need to figure out how to write all the quantities in this expression in the interaction picture. So the fields just look like this compared to the Schrodinger picture fields. But we've got in here, and in this expression, these fields, remember, phi sub 1 means phi of x1, so these are Heisenberg picture fields. So what we need is a relationship between these free fields and the Heisenberg picture fields. And in the Heisenberg picture, we know that the fields satisfy the Heisenberg equation of motion. And solution, so we solved this exactly in the case where our Hamiltonian was the Klein-Gordon Hamiltonian. In general, if we add perturbations, like for example, this perturbation, this is not an equation we can solve exactly. But there's a nice form of this solution. We know the solution will take form that it's some time-evolved version of the Schrodinger picture field operator. And so here, this is the Schrodinger picture operator. And this is a time evolution operator. And S of infinity and minus infinity is what we're calling the S matrix. The S matrix describes time evolution from the asymptotic past to the asymptotic future. And also, there'll be a solution of this form and time evolution operator will satisfy this equation. So solving this equation for the time evolution operator is equivalent for solving this first Heisenberg equation for the field operator. Questions? Okay. So if we compare these two expressions we've got relationship between the free fields in the interaction picture to the Schrodinger picture fields, and we also have a relationship between the Heisenberg picture fields and the Schrodinger picture fields. We can combine those to get what we want, which is a relationship between the Heisenberg picture fields, phi of x and t, with the interaction picture, free fields. And if we just so this is equal to, we use the relationship between the Heisenberg and Schrodinger, we've got this is s dagger of t and t naught, then times the Schrodinger picture field, which we can write as e to the plus, e to the minus I h naught t minus t naught, y naught of x and t, e to the plus I h naught t minus t naught times s. And so we'll call this combination of operators. We'll define this to be u of t and t naught. So this is u will have the interpretation of being a time evolution operator in the interaction picture. So this operator basically tells us how the interaction picture fields evolve. And so using that, we can write this as u dagger t t naught y naught of x and t. And so this time evolution operator relates our free fields to our Heisenberg picture fields. And so that's part of what we need in order to relate this time ordered product of Heisenberg picture fields to time ordered product of free fields. But we also need to know what this time evolution operator is. If we don't know what this is, then we can't compute the time ordered products we're interested in. And so, well, we know an equation for S. S satisfies this equation. And so we can just take this time derivative of our interaction picture, time evolution operator, and this is I times the derivative of e to the I, h naught t minus t naught, times s of t and t naught. And we know that this is just s times h. So we can write this then as minus the I H naught T minus T naught times H naught S T and T naught. And this is equal to S T T naught H of T. And we can also write this as, so we can write H of T as S dagger T and T naught times H of T naught times S T and T naught. So the time evolution operators relate any operators at the reference time T naught to the time T. And that will let us combine these two terms. We'll have an S, S dagger that will cancel. And what we'll be left with is e to the minus I H naught T minus T naught. Here we've got a minus H naught. And over here, after we cancel off the S and S dagger, we've got an H of T naught. And then times S. And so here we've got the total Hamiltonian minus the free Hamiltonian, which is just the interaction part of the Hamiltonian. And can write this then as H1 in the interaction picture of T times U of T and T naught, where I've used the relationship between S and H to pull out, to put in an extra, the missing factor of e to the iht. So the interaction picture operators should be related to the Heisenberg picture operators by multiplying by e to the minus ih naught t and e to the plus ih naught t. So here I've used that h1i t is related to the Heisenberg Hamiltonian in the same way, the Schrodinger picture Hamiltonian in the same way as the free fields. Plus goes there. So this is the equation we need to solve if we want to find what the interaction picture time evolution operator is, which we need in order to relate the Heisenberg picture fields to the free fields. Any questions here? Okay. So time derivative of u is proportional to u. So that's a differential equation we've solved many times. And if these were just functions instead of operators, not the natural thing to guess would be that the solution this form. This is our guess. And it's because these are operators, this isn't quite going to work, but it's rather close. And let's see why it doesn't work. We can compute the derivative of this. And what we get is, well, we can Taylor expand at this exponential. That's what we mean by this exponential. It's just one, just the usual expression for e to the x, 1 plus x squared over 2, et cetera, in terms of its Taylor series. And so the linear term will look like this. And wait, more terms, but this is sufficient to see where the problem is, this guess. So we can compute the derivatives. Derivative of 1 is 0. Derivative of this is just minus I h1i of t. Then over here, we get two terms. So missing in minus I squared minus squared over 2 times. So this is this integral times itself. And the derivative can either act on the first or the second of those integrals. And if it acts on the first integral, we get h1i of t integral h1i of t prime. And it could act on the second one, in which case we have the integral first. And h1i of t second. And if these h's are operators, and for different times, there's no reason to expect that the these operators will commute. So these two terms don't recombine into h times this integral, which is what we'd want if we wanted to be able to resum the right hand side back into an exponential. Our guess fails, but the reason it fails is because these don't commute. In general. So this doesn't work. But it's quite close, and if everything did commute, it'd be fine. And the correct answer is that if we just time order this exponential, then everything will commute. You might guess that time ordering should be involved based on the fact that we have time ordering involved in all of the Green's functions that we're trying to commute, but otherwise you can just think of this as an inspired guess. And so the correct answer is our naive guess with the time ordering. Thank you. because everything commutes inside of a time ordering symbol. And, well, so we want to interpret this as a time evolution operator. And we expect that there are time evolution operators should satisfy some properties. Among those properties are that if we time evolve for no time, we shouldn't change our system. That means we expect u of t and t to be equal to 1. So this is time evolution from time t to time t, so for no time. And our guess satisfies that boundary condition. So if we plug in t and t, then we've got an integral where the upper and lower limits of integration are the same. So that's just the integral is 0, exponential is 0, it's 1. So that works. Other properties we expect. We expect that if we time evolve, so let me introduce some shorthand notation first, because we're going to be writing a lot of these time evolution operators. So let's call u21 to be the time evolution operator from time t1 to time t2. And if we time evolve from time 1 to 2, that should be the same thing as evolving from time 2, from 2 to 1, should be the same as evolving from 1 to 2 backwards. So if we do both time evolutions, we've evolved our system forward in time, backward in time, so these two things should be inverses. Our time evolution operator should be unitary. So this should be the same thing as u21 dagger. Okay. And one other property of this time evolution operator we'll need to use, and that's a composition property. So evolving from time 1 to time 3 should be the same thing as evolving from time 1 to time 2, and then from time 2 to time 3. And so this expression, well, it clearly works based on this expression if t3 is greater than t2 is greater than t1, in which case we multiply u3 2 with u2 1, we'll just have the product of two exponentials, one from t1 to t2, and the other one from t2 to t3. And so when we multiply the exponentials, we can add their arguments, and we get two integrals over domains that meet at a point, so we can just do the integral once and for all. So it works for that case. This works if t3 is greater than t2, greater than t1. And we can multiply this equation by u12 on the right, or u23 on the left, in order to get a similar relation in the other cases. So for example, we multiply by u23 on the left, we get u23, u31 is u23, u32, u21. u23 times u32 is 1 by this property. Evolving forward and backwards in time shouldn't do anything. So this is u21. So we see that it works for any time ordering So here it works for different time ordering. Tier 3 is the latest time ordering, and we can multiply by U12 on the right to get the last permutation. Any questions on this? Okay. So let's remind ourselves why we are interested in this time evolution operator. And that's because what we're trying to compute are these time ordered expectation values. So what we're trying to compute is this product and we've done most of what we need. We have a way to relate these Heisenberg picture field operators to the free field operators in the interaction picture. We've figured out both what the they're related by this time evolution operator, and we've got a form, an expression for this time evolution operator. What we haven't discussed yet is the relationship between this interacting vacuum and the free vacuum. So we want to figure out what the vacuum looks like in the interaction picture. And key observation to do this, and what we need is the, so remember in the LSE formula, our we cared about what the states were in the asymptotic past and the asymptotic future. So what we need are the expressions for the interacting vacuum in the far past and in the far future. And the key observation to relate this interacting vacuum to the free vacuum is we can note that the free annihilation operator should annihilate the free vacuum at any time. So that means that AP of T acting on 0 should be 0. But we can write this as e to the I H naught T minus T naught AP e to the minus I H naught T minus T naught 0. This is the annihilation operator at the time T naught, where all of our pictures agree. And so if this is 0, then this part should be 0. This is just some phase. It's not going to map something that's non-zero to something that's 0. So we should have that AP T naught e to the minus I H naught T minus T naught is 0. Thank you. We also know that at the time t naught, the free and interacting annihilation operators are the same. Everything agrees at the time t naught. That's where our pictures match up. And so that tells us then that AP of t naught times S of t and t naught acting on omega should be zero. And so if the vacuum is unique, then these two states should be proportional. So a free vacuum, which is annihilated by this combination of operators, should be proportional to our interacting vacuum. And so we should have then that omega is some normalization. And what we care about is the interacting vacuum in the far past. So what we're interested in is the limit t goes to minus infinity, this, which is just S dagger of t t naught e to the minus I h naught t minus t naught. But this is nothing other than the time evolution operator. So our time evolution operators were defined here on the top of the board, just e to the I h naught s. This is just u dagger, which is the same as u evolved in the opposite order. So we can write this as ni u0 minus infinity. Zero. And similarly, we're interested in the interacting bra vacuum in the far future. So the normalization constant is not necessarily the same, but otherwise this argument is exactly the same. So we time evolve our free vacuum to the far future, which you get something proportional to the interaction vacuum. Yes.
I have two questions.
Sure.
The first question is, see the first line on this board?
Yes.
Do we like impose that on our system, or does it follow from something else?
So this basically follows from the fact that all of our pictures agree at the time t naught. So our annihilation operators react on the interacting vacuum, we should get the same thing as we in the Heisenberg picture or in the interaction picture.
And then where does the second line of that board come from?
This one? Okay, so this comes from these are two different states that are both annihilated by our annihilation operators at this time t. So they should be proportional. So I have set, so here's this is a proportionality constant. And these, but apart from this proportionality constant, these two expressions should be equal. If I just set them equal, I can get rid of the annihilation operator. And I've just multiplied this one by S dagger. So I've said that S of t, t naught, omega is equal to some normalization constant times e to the minus I h naught t minus t naught 0 multiplied by S dagger on the left. And we're only interested in this state in the far future. Far past. So that's because we're ultimately interested in computing from the LSE formula from Friday. We were looking at the scattering of states. Our initial states were defined in the asymptotic past. Our final states were defined in the asymptotic future. And so what we're ultimately interested in doing is looking at the m-order expectation value that shows up on the right-hand side of the LSE formula. There, what we care about is the past and far future.
Sorry, could you explain again why the first line is 0? I didn't get.
The first line is 0. Okay, so I'll try a different way to explain it. So this annihilation operator is the same in all three pictures. And so we've got the vacuum state at some time. We can time evolve the vacuum state. So time the vacuum state at time T naught should be annihilated by this. Maybe that's a better way to say that is if we've got AP of T. So in the Heisenberg picture, AP of T should annihilate the vacuum. That's basically what we mean by the vacuum and by the annihilation operators. And we can write AP of T as S dagger of T naught, T and T naught, AP of T naught, S of T and T naught, times omega, and this should be 0. And our time evolution operator should never map something that's non-zero to something that's 0. So if this is 0, then this part has to be 0.
Sorry, why is S but not U?
This is the Heisenberg picture. So our original expression for the endpoint function we're trying to compute, that's in the Heisenberg picture. We've got field operators that depend on space and time. So those are Heisenberg picture field operators. And so we want to understand how to relate, our goal is to relate our Heisenberg picture field operators to our interaction picture field operators where we can calculate things. But when we derived the LSE formula, our final expression had a time-ordered expectation value in the Heisenberg picture. And so we need to understand how to relate each of the pieces of this expression that it occurred on the right-hand side of the LSE formula. We need to understand how to write each of these Heisenberg picture objects in the interaction picture. So one of the things we started out with was any other questions on this? We've got basically all the ingredients now. So what I'll do next is put them together if everyone's happy with each of the individual pieces. Sure.
Question. So are these omegas always in the Heisenberg picture, the states?
Well, in this, we could write them in the Schrodinger picture, but in this expression, our fields are spent on time, which up to now, that's a big clue that we were in the Heisenberg picture. Because Schrodinger picture, our operators should be time independent, our states.
So is the difference between the free vacuum and the interacting vacuum, is that the interacting vacuum is like not at t equals minus infinity or infinity or something?
They don't have to have the same. I mean, essentially, what this equation is saying is that we can get from the free vacuum to the interacting vacuum just by doing time evolution. Although it's not quite just time evolution, so this is the they're in different pictures, right? So, but to go from the interacting vacuum to the free vacuum, they're related just by time evolution. But this time evolution using the interaction picture time evolution operator. So you can imagine doing time evolution only using the perturbation to our Hamiltonian. And if we started with a free vacuum, time evolved it, we'd end up with an interacting vacuum. In that sense, the difference between the two is just time evolution.
So if you only regular time evolved it, would it still be the free vacuum?
So without this?
Yeah.
Okay, so without this, we just be evolving with the full time evolution operator in the whole theory. And I guess you'd have to tell me what you meant by the free vacuum then if we didn't have some. In this equation, I know what's meant by the free vacuum because there's some implicitly some specification of the free Hamiltonian. If I take this part out, then what I meant by the free vacuum would depend on how I broke up my Hamiltonian in general, I guess. I'm not sure if... another way to put it is that we only really have an interacting theory. We're just by hand treating it as a free theory and some perturbation, and so we were able to calculate it. But physically, physically, this one is the real vacuum that's actually actually the vacuum of our theory. This is just a construct we're introducing in order to make our calculations work.
Really understand the difference between all of the vacuums.
Okay. Well, maybe we could say, imagine we started off with turning off our perturbations. So in the far past, our Hamiltonian is just a Klein-Gordon Hamiltonian, and this would be the vacuum. We could turn on, at some finite time, some perturbations. And then we could imagine what's the vacuum in the far past will no longer be the vacuum. Well, here this is assuming in the far past, but if we forget about this, then we could time evolve using this combination where this was just our initial Hamiltonian. Because in the far past, we're imagining we're turning off all the perturbations and our Hamiltonian is the free Hamiltonian. And then we could time evolve and what we'd end up with, we started in the free vacuum state in the far past would be some different state related to our initial state by time evolution.
Okay. I mean, that would make sense if you have the S term was like a continued time evolution, but it looks like they're both time evolutions from minus infinity to T naught. So, do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, well, so if we just started in a free vacuum and our Hamiltonian was the free Hamiltonian for all time, we would stay in that state.
Yeah. Are you saying that, so for some time we evolve under the free Hamiltonian and then afterwards we evolve under the full Hamiltonian?
Yeah. That's the physical scenario I can imagine where you could talk about both. We'll look at an example tutorial where we can see that. We'll turn on a perturbation sometime. Yes.
Like the state of the omega is written in the propagator is from zero to negative infinity. You do the dagger to all the state above the down below the propagator. Should be negative infinity to zero, but why you change the sign?
So this zero is referring to the time t naught.
Yeah. According to above, there's the second, third line u12 is equal to u21 dagger.
Right.
The above blackboard.
Yes, this up there.
Yeah. U12 is equal to U21 dagger.
Right.
So you take the dagger of U naught to minus infinity. Should that be U minus infinity to naught?
That would be a different expression for this vacuum. But what we care about is this vacuum defined in the far future. Would it be this? Take the dagger of this, we'd get u dagger minus infinity zero, something like this, which is u of zero infinity. Minus infinity. So there are different expressions for this. This will be the useful one. Now put our results together. So we're trying to compute the right-hand side of the LSD formula as time-ordered product of fields. And let's assume that they're already time-ordered. Just to save some writing. Then we get, forget about the time ordering. P They're not time ordered, we could just relabel. So it's not much of an assumption. And we can just plug in our results so far. So we have two different normalization constants. The free vacuum times U infinity zero, that's the bra vacuum. Then phi of x1 is U zero one times the free field at x1 times U one zero. The second one will give us a U 0, 2, phi 0 of x2, u, 2, 0, all the way up to u, 0, n, phi 0 of xn, u, n, 0, then our pit vacuum is u infinity, u 0 and minus infinity acting on 0. And we can then use our composition rule lots of times. And what we get is U infinity 1, phi naught of x1, U 1 2, phi naught of x2, all the way up to U n minus 1, n, phi naught of xn, U n minus infinity, zero. Composition property. And then we can note that all the operators here are already time ordered. So we can throw in a time ordering symbol. So by assumption, T1 is greater than T2, so all these operators are at earlier and earlier times as we go to the right in time order, which means inside the time ordering symbol, we can move things around however we like. And in particular, we can bring this u1 infinity next to this u1 2, use the composition property. And this u1 2 will also, we can move it next to a u2 3. And so everything is going to collapse down to a single time evolution operator from minus infinity to infinity. And there, that's a big simplification from what we started with. And we can do a little bit better if we demand, if we can choose that our interacting vacuum is unit normalized. And well, if we compute our the inner product of omega with omega, we get ni nf 0 u infinity minus infinity 0. And so that tells us what ni nf is. So we can write this then as 0 t phi of 0 x1 to phi naught of xn u infinity minus infinity 0, and normalization constant is 0 u infinity minus infinity 0. Okay, so we're almost there. We have an expression for u in terms of the interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction picture. What we'd like is to be able to write everything in terms of the field. So we're imagining our interaction Hamiltonian is just some polynomial in our fields, usually. So the last thing we need to do is write our interaction Hamiltonian in terms of the fields. And so remember, u of infinity minus infinity was just the time ordered exponential of minus I integral d3x hi I h1i. So we need to write this h1i in terms of the free fields. Any questions on that? Okay. So this will be easiest to do if we just look at an example. And let's go back to the example from the beginning of lecture, where we assumed our interaction, our perturbation to the Hamiltonian was just a pi to the 4 term. And so we know that all of our pictures agree at time t naught. So we compute our Hamiltonian or h1 at time t naught. That's the same, will be the same in any of our pictures. Just this. This has to be the same thing as this. We can write that at this time, we can write it in terms of free fields. And so we want to compute h1i of t. You can write that as e to the I h naught t minus t naught integral done here is just want to go to the take an operator at our fixed time. The time dependence of that operator in the interaction picture just means we multiply on the left and the right by these exponentials involving free Hamiltonian. And so we can think about this term as phi naught times phi naught times phi naught times phi naught at times t naught. And we can multiply by, in between each of these factors, we can multiply by e to the plus I h naught, e to the minus I h naught. So here we can multiply by e to the plus I h naught, e to the minus I h naught, and same for each of them. And then what we've got here is e to the plus I h naught by naught at time t naught times e to the minus I H naught. This is too small, but the idea is just in between each of these four fields, multiply by this times this, and that just gives us back the interaction picture field, time-dependent interaction picture field. So we just get integral d3x and over 4 factorial pi naught to the fourth of x and t. Because these time-dependent interaction picture fields are related to the time-dependent or time-independent or the free fields at this fixed time. Yeah. And so, very simple to summarize the results. You want to go from the Heisenberg picture perturbation in the Hamiltonian to the interaction picture. Just replace the Heisenberg picture fields with free fields. Very simple. And so, you our time evolution operator from the far past to the far future. It's just a time ordered exponential. And we're almost exclusively interested in the case where our perturbation is are just some polynomial in the fields, in which case these are part of the potential term. And then we can write this in terms of the Lagrangian, which is a more useful way to write it because we're almost always given the Lagrangian rather than the Hamiltonian. Lagrangian, it's easy to check whether things are Lorentz invariant. And so this is the most useful form of the expression for the time evolution operator, written in terms of the Lagrangian, where the L int would be the free Lagrangian minus the total Lagrangian minus the free Lagrangian. And this notation just means that we take whatever our original Heisenberg picture Lagrangian is, that depends on the interacting fields, and just replace those interacting fields with free fields. And we get the interaction picture result. And so this gives us our final formula. Yes?
What happens to the genre transform part? When you're going between eight.
Okay, so you're worried about what would happen if there were kinetic terms or time derivatives in the interaction?
Well, aren't you adding the momentum times the field to get between the
So our Hamiltonian would be I phi dot the integral of this minus L. And so if our interaction part doesn't depend on any time derivatives, then we'll just get a minus sign. We're going back and forth. That's the case where we're only going to be interested in this course, and that's the case we're most often interested, even beyond that. So we'll assume that throughout the course. So we can now plug this in and get our final expression for these time-ordered expectation values. So this is Dyson's formula. And is one of the key results of today's lecture. And I'd like to just point out, though, that even though I've been talking throughout the lecture about a perturbation, I'm adding a perturbation to our Hamiltonian or Lagrangian, and treating things in terms of a free evolution and perturbation to the evolution, we've made no approximations. So this result is exact. We haven't made any approximations. But to proceed further, in most cases, we will need to make approximations. And the way we usually do that is by expanding the exponential in terms of a Taylor series. So once we do that, if the interaction Lagrangian is a polynomial in the fields, which it usually is, then both the numerator and the denominator are just, as promised, expectation values of time-ordered products of free fields. So that's what we need to learn how to compute. So expectation values of products of free fields. But no approximations have been made at this point. Any questions on that result? Okay, so what we need to compute now are Green's functions in the free theory. Free Green's functions, so free fields. So each of the terms, once we Taylor expand this exponential, will involve at least n fields in the numerator, more if there's additional fields here, and terms in the denominator will involve some number of fields. And the way we can do this is using Wick's theorem. I'll state the result and then discuss why it's true later. So the statement of Wick's theorem is that the time-ordered product is equal to the normal ordered product of all possible contractions. Okay. So remember, normal ordering means moving all of the annihilation operators to the left, all the creation operators to the left. Alternatively, you can think about normal ordering of an operator as taking the operator and subtracting off its vacuum expectation value. Those are the same thing. because if we take the expectation value of any normal ordered operator, it's got all of the annihilation operators to the right, so it'll annihilate the vacuum, and all the creation operators to the left, which will annihilate the raw vacuum from the right. And here, all possible contractions. So what all possible means, first, what is a contraction? So a contraction means replacing a pair of fields. With the Feynman propagator. And all possible means contracting anywhere between 0 up to n over 2 if there's an even number of fields, pairs of fields. And so Wick's theorem is true. This is a statement about operators. What we care about really is this vacuum expectation value. And note that if we have a normal ordered operator, then its expectation value is 0. So the only way we can get something non-zero here is if instead of an operator inside the normal ordering, we just have a function. So the only way that only terms in this all possible contractions that will contribute to the vacuum expectation values we care about are the ones where all of the fields are contracted. And that'll only be possible if there's an even number of fields. Otherwise, we'll always have one left over. So if we have an even number of fields, we can contract all the fields, and we'll get some expression involving the Feynman propagator. And so, there's some notation we use for contraction. So if we have two fields, phi naught of x and phi naught of y, and draw the contraction like this. That's the same regardless of whether I draw them contracted above or below the fields. So that's the same thing. And that's equal to the Feynman propagator. And so we can prove this. It's useful to break up the fields into parts that involve creation operators and the parts that involve the annihilation operators. Call phi sub plus as the part that involves the creation operator, and phi sub minus the part that involves the annihilation operator. And so we look at the commutator of phi minus with phi plus. We just get the integral of e to the minus I e dot x minus y times a p with a k dagger And this will just kill one of these denominators. So we'll get just integral d3p. Which is what we called in an earlier lecture d of x minus y. And we, our result from before was that Feynman propagator of x minus y was d of x minus y minus theta of x minus y plus d of y minus x theta of y minus x. Okay, so for two fields, we can prove Wick's theorem in a few lines. And the way we can do that is just by expanding out phi naught of x1 and phi naught of x2 in terms of phi plus and phi minus. We get four terms, phi plus, plus, which is already normal ordered. It only involves creation operators. Phi plus, phi minus, which is already normal ordered. We've got the creation operators to the left. We'll have then phi minus, phi plus, which is not normal ordered. We have the creation operators to the right. And then we have phi minus, which is normal ordered. So we need to commute these two in order to normal order this. So we get phi of normal ordered product of these two fields plus the commutator we need to add in order to put these in the correct order. And so there's only, all right, so this is assuming, I've assumed here that x, t1 is greater than t2. I put all the phi x1s to the left. And for t2 greater than t1, we'll just switch everything. So for t2 greater than t1, switch x1 and x2. And that gives us the result. So we get time ordered product is equal to the normal ordered product plus the Feynman propagator. These two things are d of x minus y, d of y minus x, same results from before. Yes.
Should that be plus on the second guy in the commutator?
Yes, it should be. Thank you. Absolutely correct. Otherwise, it would be zero. Thank you. Okay. So the general case can follow from induction. So we can assume it holds for n minus 1. And let's assume also that t1 is the latest time. Otherwise, we can relabel. Then our time ordered product by assumption is phi naught of x1 times the normal ordering of all possible contractions that don't involve x1. And, well, then we can break up phi naught into phi plus and phi minus. Times this same normal ordering. And this first term is already normal ordered. This is a creation operator, it's to the far left. So this part's normal ordering, so we can just bring this inside the normal ordering. Phi minus, on the other hand, needs to go to the far right. And so we have to move phi minus past each of the uncontracted fields. So if a field is contracted, then we just have a Feynman propagator. The Feynman propagator is a function, not an operator. So we can bring it past. So every in this sum over all possible contractions not involving x1, every time we've got an uncontracted field and we move a phi minus past it, we'll just pick up a contraction with each of the uncontracted fields. And so in that way, we'll get all the possible contractions between that don't involve phi 1. And from commuting this term past each of the uncontracted fields, we'll get all the possible contractions that do involve phi 1. And so that just gives us the result. Just go give you a simple example of how to use this. So what we're most interested in doing is using this inside of vacuum excitation values, in which case only completely contracted fields survive the vacuum excitation value. And in this case, so we're looking for all of the ways to completely contract these four fields. And so there are four possible ways to contract them. Three possible ways to contract all four fields. So we can contract x1 and x2. And that forces us then to contract x3 and x4. Alternatively, we can contract x1 with x3. And that forces us to contract x2 with x4. Or we could contract x1 with x4. And that forces us to contract x2 with x3. And so the contractions are just Feynman propagators. So we get delta 1, 2, delta 3, 4, plus delta 1, 3, delta 2, 4, plus delta 1, 4, delta 2, 3. An example of how to use that. And so in principle, now you have everything you need in order to calculate scattering cross sections and decay rates. Taking us three lectures to get here. So we can go from the scattering cross section to the scattering amplitude to the Green's functions in the inner acting theory, which we related via the interaction picture to Green's functions in a free theory, and then via Wick's theorem to products of Feynman propagators. In principle, you could follow this chain of reasoning and compute any scattering cross-section or decay rate you like, or at least write down an analytic expression for it. In practice, the methods we've seen so far are a little bit cumbersome and can be simplified using a method due to Feynman, Feynman diagrams, which is entirely equivalent to what we've done here. So basically, what we're going to do tomorrow is just encode everything we've done in the last three lectures into some pictures that will allow us to jump through three lectures worth of results in a single lecture. Questions? See you in tutorial.